Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. First up, in a few minutes, we'll speak with the economist Lance Lochner of the University of Western Ontario about the effects of education on social indicators like crime, health, and civic participation. And around the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Vijay Prashad of Trinity College about the revolution in Egypt. Before that, a few words in the employment report for January. As I always point out when doing these reviews, the monthly employment release from the Bureau of Labor Statistics is based on two very large surveys, one of 300,000 employers called the Establishment Survey, and one of 60,000 households. And as I often point out when doing these reviews, the numbers are not cooked, as many conspiratorial sorts want to believe. You might take issue with some of their definitions, particularly of unemployment, but the work is done by serious, honest people who want to tell the truth. Indeed, one of the more curious features of American life is that we have an excellent statistical apparatus that tells us reams about this society, a lot of it disgraceful, but almost no one seems to care. As Poe demonstrated in the purloined letter, sometimes the best place to hide something is in the open. Now to the employment numbers. There was an unusually large divergence between the two surveys this month, with the establishment survey looking rather weak and the household survey rather strong. The truth is probably somewhere in between the two. Weather was awful in January, but explains only part of the weakness in the headline payroll number. Total employment rose by just 36,000, only about a quarter of the recent average. But stunningly, manufacturing is up 49,000. We haven't seen a rise of that magnitude in percentage terms since 1990. Private services were up just 32,000. Several important service sectors shed jobs, and many turned in performances well below recent trends. The recently mighty eat, drink, and get sick subsectors, bars and restaurants and healthcare, who have been going like gangbusters, added just 6,000, a fifth of their recent average. Average hourly earnings, though, are up the most in nearly 2 years. A combination of weak job gains and strong wage gains, after a long period of very weak wage gains, by the way, has some Wall Street types worried about a return to stagflation, but I think the stag part is far more of a risk than the inflation part. With the job market as weak as it is, the likelihood of a burst of sustained wage growth seems very remote. The household numbers were considerably stronger. Total employment rose by a very strong 589,000. At the same time, the ranks of the unemployed fell by 590,000. Those developments combined to take the unemployment rate down by a four-tenths of a percentage point to 9.0%, its lowest level since May 2009. That definition of unemployment requires that people be actively looking for work. The broad U6 rate, as it's called, which includes people who want full-time work but can only find part-time, as well as those who've given up the job search as hopeless, fell a sharp six-tenths of a point to 16.1%, still high, but it's the lowest level since April 2009. So, the job market continues to improve slowly, but is still quite bad. There are about 5 unemployed people for every reported job opening, not far from an all-time high. Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke gave a speech the other day in which he said that he suspected that the unemployment rate will stay quite high for a long time, and he's almost certainly right about that. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about education. That was a bit of Karlheinz Stockhausen's Struktur, the seventh section. My first guest is Lance Lochner, an economist at the University of Western Ontario and author of a recent paper for the National Bureau of Economic Research on some of the social payoffs of education. Lance Lochner. Economists look to education as a way to increase productivity, but it seems to have many other payoffs as well. Let's talk about a few of those, starting with crime. Is there a link between years of education and the crime rate?
Oh, yes. I think there's over the last 5 years, economists have been looking pretty closely at this question, and overwhelmingly the evidence is that there's a link and that it's causal. That is, increases in education actually cause people to commit less crime.
Well, first give us some idea of the quantitative relationship. How much will, say, an additional year of schooling accomplish?
The sort of the best estimates out there today suggest that an extra year of school would reduce subsequent arrests and incarceration rates, both by about 10 to 15% in the U.S., and that holds for both the violent and property crime.
And why would this be the case?
There's a number of theories, I guess, competing theories. I don't know if we know exactly why yet, but some of the sort of theories out there are that that schooling might promote sort of socialization efforts and empathy for others. There's stories about other kinds of ways it might alter your preferences in certain terms of risk taking and how patient you are, or how much self-control you can exert. There's some theories about the interaction of peers and whether being around the right group of peers or different groups of peers might affect how much crime you decide to engage in. And I think sort of one of the theories I favor a bit more is a more simple one, and it's really about labor market opportunities and education. We know from decades of research that it improves labor market options for people and increases wages. This theory basically suggests that by increasing wages and legitimate opportunities, criminal opportunities just don't look as good anymore.
Yeah, I guess the income from like street crime is not really all that high, is it?
Yeah, most of the evidence suggests it's actually quite low, and the numbers we've sort of found suggest, you know, it's about the kind of wages you'd earn if you're a high school dropout or right around a high school graduate. So it's not a particularly lucrative activity for most people.
Although the risk is kind of high.
Yeah, exactly. So sort of you're earning what a dropout earns, and plus you have to spend every few years in jail. So it's not a particularly good choice for most people.
That's maybe a little bit speculative, but would additional education enable people to make those kinds of risk-reward calculations a little better than they would if they'd dropped out?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know if we know the answer to it. Presumably that's one of the things we're trying to teach people in school, basic skills like that. I don't know that there's I don't know that there's any evidence that that's what's going on, but that's certainly a plausible story.
Now, you say that the evidence is pretty firm that this is causal, but how do we know that, you know, just the fact that the kinds of people who are more likely to stay in school are less likely to commit crimes? I mean, is the education intervention an independent variable, or is that actually just an expression of a certain kind of set of characters or preferences?
Yeah, well, this is actually where most of the new research in the last few years has spent a lot of time trying to deal with this issue. The question is, if you take these high school dropouts that we know commit a large share of the crime, do we know that sending them to school an extra year or getting them to finish high school is actually going to change them? And that's where most of the evidence has come back, that indeed it does. And a few of the ways people have tried to look at it, one of the ways we looked at it was to look at what happens when you change schooling laws to require people to stay in school an extra year or two. And what you find is those cohorts that are forced is a loose word. Not everybody actually follows the law. But among those cohorts that face a higher schooling age requirement, we see their schooling increases, we see their earnings increase, and we see their subsequent criminal activity decline.
I think there's some skepticism among people about the value of education for poorer segments of the population. They may get a degree, but are the jobs available? Is that a problem, that you may be educating people for jobs that might not be available, so they may not do so much crime prevention if this becomes a broader social policy?
Ooh, well, all of the evidence out there suggests one thing for sure, that if you don't have an education, there are no jobs. You know, there's a bigger question of whether sort of jobs are available at sort of the high school graduate level, and whether those jobs are harder to come by. I think that's true. But I think the overwhelming evidence is that if you don't have that high school degree, you're in much worse shape than ever before. So, you know, everything's relative at some level, and I think all of the evidence suggests now more than ever getting a high school degree and attending college has a big payoff in terms of earnings and in terms of some of these other dimensions.
And now what about if you educate people a lot, will they become the Bernie Madoffs of the future? I mean, is there an increase in white-collar crime that might offset partly the decrease in more violent or property crimes?
I looked a little bit at that at some earlier work, although there's been very, very little work on white-collar crime and the sort of the effects of education on it. I did find, indeed, that unlike most sort of typical violent and property crimes, if increasing education seems to have lead to a small increase in crimes like embezzlement, fraud, and forgery. So there is a sense in which that's probably something you might expect. We don't quite know, I don't think, in part because people haven't looked at it that closely, but we don't quite know how big that is. And my guess is the sort of the social costs associated with that are going to be swamped by the benefits from reductions in much more serious violent crimes.
Some of Bernie Madoff's clients might disagree. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other benefits of increased education that might not be so obvious. It does seem to improve people's health and mortality figures, doesn't it?
True. This is sort of another area where there's been a lot of very recent research, a lot of it sort of using the same sort of empirical methods of looking at when schooling laws change, do we see sort of subsequent benefits in terms of health and mortality. And the evidence on health is I think fairly strong and tells sort of paints a picture of roughly sort of 10% improvements in a wide range of different health dimensions. It tends to lead to increasing schooling, tends to reduce smoking, the evidence on mortality is a bit mixed, and in part the numbers are small, so trying to sort of tease out how big the impact is on something that's a very unlikely event in any given year is hard. I think the evidence is a bit mixed, although it suggests that there is some benefit in terms of people living longer if they finish high school or go to college.
Now, what would the mechanism be? Is it that people learn better behaviors? Is it getting more education puts you into a higher income bracket, which is, of course, positively associated with health outcomes? What's the mechanism?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question right now. I think there's been a growing evidence that the benefits are there, that the effects are there. Right now, what you've seen recently is people trying to figure out what it is, and I guess there's probably two or three main competing stories there. One is the simple one that you suggested, that you have higher earnings, better job opportunities that provide more health care. My guess is, ballpark number, is that explains about 30 to 50% of the reductions. There's also or improvements in health. The other two competing stories are, I guess, one is sort of that people that are more educated make better health choices. They sort of take advantage of new medicines when they come out or better treatments that lead to better health outcomes. The other story is sort of one a more simple story that somehow, I guess it's a bit related to that you're better informed about what your options are, et cetera.
And then civic participation, voting and such, more education leads to more of that, right?
Right. Well, we see, at least in the U.S. anyway, that seems to be true. We see that increases in education either at the college or the high school age appears to increase the probability that people vote or register to vote. Probability that they are interested in political issues and get involved. The evidence in Europe is a bit weaker in that sense. There's not nearly the effect we see in voting or registration, in part because registration is mandatory, and I think voting rates are quite a bit higher there.
And again, we have to separate out the education effect from the income effect, because people in higher income categories do vote more than people in lower income categories. Is this really an income thing, or is it some separate influence of education itself?
Ooh, well, it it is an effect. The evidence is when you change education, you get these effects. Whether the entire effect is because you're wealthier and have higher income, or something else that education is doing, that I don't think we know the answer to.
There are certainly social payoffs from a less criminal, more involved, and healthier population. So this may be a cynical question to ask, but how's the cost-benefit work out? Education is not cheap. Is there actually a monetary payoff from extending education operating on through these channels?
Well, that's a tricky question. I think the evidence on crime is quite strong and supportive of I think policies targeted in particular to lower education levels, targeted to improving our worst inner city schools. Among high crime sort of groups, or groups that have sort of fairly high crime rates to begin with, I think the evidence is pretty strong that educational investments have a high payoff. The health numbers are a bit trickier. It does look like that there are payoffs to it, although it's a little bit unclear. Most of those benefits tend to accrue to the individual themselves. As economists, we tend to think that government doesn't necessarily need to sort of help people make decisions that they should already be sort of considering themselves. If they're going to benefit by living longer and having a healthier life, then presumably they take that into account when they make their schooling choices. Now, maybe they don't, or maybe they don't know about it. That's sort of more of a gray area. The civic returns in terms of voting and these kind of political activism, that presumably is a benefit to society at large, not just the individual. And again, might be an argument for promoting education. Right now, there's real no hard numbers on how valuable that actually is, though.
You've done a lot of other work on access to education, financing education. It's certainly getting very difficult for a lot of people to afford higher education, and now that states are cutting budgets like crazy, it's going to get even harder. Is this good social policy when you hit budget trouble to really jack up college tuition and cut back on primary and secondary education? This access problem, is this going to give us some troubles in the future?
Well, I certainly wouldn't think you'd find too many people arguing that a good policy is to cut education in a period when the economy is not doing well. I think one thing I found in some of my most recent research is that indeed the relationship between family income and whether students attend college has gotten a lot stronger over the last 25 years. If you were to sort of follow cohorts in the early 1980s and look at, you know, how much, once you sort of control for ability and family background and sort of try and take sort of kids that look similar on test scores and parental background, you didn't find much difference in terms of whether they went to college or not based on whether their family had a high or a low income. On the other hand, you fast forward to about 5 years ago and look at cohorts from the early 2000s and you see a much bigger, stronger relationship. So something is already going on even before the financial crisis, in part related most likely to the rise in returns to schooling and the sort of the often discussed rise in costs. So despite a lot of effort by the U.S. to sort of provide Pell Grants and aid at the low end of the income distribution, we still see a tremendously strong relationship between income, family income, and whether someone goes to college.
I was Lance Lochner of the University of Western Ontario. A few more words about the education premium and access to higher education, taking off from the interview we just heard. This is based on a piece I wrote for the newsletter I edit, Left Business Observer. You can find the full piece, along with lots of thrilling graphs, on the LBO website, leftbusinessobserver.com. That's all one word, leftbusinessobserver.com. There will be a link headlined College from the front page to help you find it. As everyone knows, the way to get ahead these days is by accumulating degrees. A rising education premium, as they say in economics, is the favorite official explanation for the increase in inequality over the last three decades. That's far from a complete explanation, of course. It overlooks the decline of unions and the erosion of the minimum wage, but there's no doubt that the further you get in school, the more money you make. The problem is that it's getting harder to pay the freight. The numbers on the education premium are striking. Back in the mid-70s, high school dropouts earned about 20% less than those who got a diploma. That deficiency has expanded now to over 30%. but the average college grad earns over 80% more than a high school grad, those with advanced degrees 160% more. But how the price of grabbing credentials has risen. Inflation in college tuition almost makes the medical kind look reasonable. Since 1980, the Consumer Price Index for medical care is up about 2.5 times as much as the overall CPI, but that for college tuition is up almost 5 times as much. Such rates of inflation leave family incomes in the dust. According to the College Board, posted annual costs for attending a typical private four-year institution were 26% of average family incomes in 1979. They're now 58%, more than twice as much. For public four-year institutions, the bite went from 12 to 25% of average incomes over the same period, also more than a doubling. The cost of attending a public university as a percentage of family income is now almost as heavy as the cost of attending a private one 3 decades ago. Of course, as the old saying goes, only suckers pay retail. There is aid available, especially for poorer families, and not all of it is loans. But many barriers still remain. Even after accounting for financial aid, the cost of attending a four-year public institution for a student from the poorest quarter of the income distribution is nearly half a year's income. For a private college, the cost to the poorest quartile is nearly a year's income. The burden has risen more slowly for the upper brackets, but even for a family in the second richest quartile, average income around $80,000, a year at a public college still costs about 2 months of a family's average income after aid. Of course, better-off parents have savings to dip into, or grandparents to put the touch on. Still, students from all but the richest families now have to borrow to attend a public university. No wonder two-thirds of college graduates now emerge with massive debts. These costs are keeping students from poorer families out of college. Thanks to the invaluable work of Tom Mortensen, publisher of Post-Secondary Education Opportunity, we've got an excellent handle on how this has played out over time. Between 1970 and 2008, the share of kids from the bottom quarter of the income distribution getting a degree by age 24 rose from 6% to 9%. For the top quarter, it rose from 55 to 95%. Clearly, there are a lot of cultural barriers for poor people getting to college, and maybe some of them have no desire even to try, but there's no doubt that money is also a major factor. Oh, and Lance Lochner, the economist we just heard from, has done work showing that students from the top quarter of the income distribution are 45 percentage points more likely to go to college than those in the bottom in the United States, but in Canada, the difference is less than half that, 20 points. The income gaps are wider in the U.S. than Canada, and college is more expensive here. Why has the cost of college risen so sharply in the U.S.? At the very high end, elite universities are in something of an arms race to get the most desirable students. They want to pamper and seduce with everything from food courts to saunas to super colliders. And since they typically offer poor students full scholarships, the elite can assuage any class guilt they suffer by presenting themselves as selection agents for the meritocracy, which they are to some degree, if not the degree they'd like to imagine. But the real crisis of college affordability is among the public institutions. And the reason for that is pretty straightforward: sharp declines in public support. For example, the University of Virginia, one of the so-called public Ivies, got a third of its budget from the state in 1989. That was down to 12% in 2009. Tuition accounted for 19% of revenue in 1989 and 31% in 2009. In other words, the state and families have essentially swapped roles in paying for higher ed. Nationally, state and local funding has fallen hard since 1980, and students and their parents have taken its place. That reversed the trend of the previous 20 years. Between 1980 and 2008, the share of higher ed expenditures coming from the government fell by almost 19 percentage points, the amount by which personal expenditures had to increase because federal support was about flat. It would not be hard at all to make higher education completely free in the USA. It accounts for not quite 2% of GDP. The personal share, about 1% of GDP, is a third of the income of the richest 10,000 households in the United States, or about 3 months of Pentagon spending. It's equal to about 4 months spending on what we waste on administrative costs by not having a single-payer healthcare finance system. But mention any of this in an election campaign, and you would be regarded as suicidally insane. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. back after a musical break.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and chip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading the charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from the Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal.
That was Gil Scott-Heron, of course. Someone pointed out to me earlier this week that in Egypt the revolution has been televised. My next guest is Vijay Prashad, who teaches history and international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He's here to talk about that Egyptian revolution. A correction to what follows. When I brought up Frank Wisner's employment at AIG, Vijay contradicted me. But in fact, I was right. Wisner, whom Obama sent to Egypt as a personal emissary the other day, did work for a while at AIG. He's also on the board of an Egyptian bank. So clearly he's very well qualified to do this important diplomatic work. Vijay Prashad. Welcome, Vijay. Let's talk first about Frank Wisner. The president recently sent him off as his special delegate to Cairo. Wisner is a man with a long history, not only his own, but his father's as well. So let's give a little bit of the background of the Frank Wisners.
Frank Wisner is a legend in the CIA. Everybody knows who he is. You know, he had his hands in three of the most important coup d'etats of the 20th century. One was Arbenz in Guatemala. The other was Mossadegh in Iran. There he, of course, wasn't, we don't think he was there in person. He had sent the hitman. Kermit Roosevelt was the man on the ground, but Wisner apparently was an engineer. And the third was in Guyana, where he apparently was the man who devised the view of raising up the working class in the city against Jagan. So Frank Wisner Sr., remarkable career in the CIA of overthrowing governments.
He's famous for the mighty Wurlitzer, right? The CIA's propaganda apparatus.
Yes, exactly. But then mysteriously in 65, he committed suicide. And his son, in a sense, became the heir of this incredible legacy and rose quickly in Washington. He was the favored child, you know, the golden boy of the Washington establishment. He was sent on a number of ambassadorial postings, including three most important, Egypt, the Philippines, and India. And he was in Clinton's Defense Department. You know, he's been in almost in the last 10 years in all the most important of those groups of eminences, you know, where they gather around and write reports about what to do in the Middle East or what to do about, say, you know, some problems in American domestic policy. Wisner is of the elite section that includes Jim Baker, for instance. So he is often the Democrat when Baker is the Republican.
As the New York Times put it with its great talent for euphemism, Wisner has long operated at the nexus of business and government. Tell us about the business side of Wisner.
Right. You know, like many of these gentlemen of the very top, Wisner has been in and out of government and corporate boards. The board that interested me the most was when, in 1997, Frank Wisner Jr. joined the board of Enron. At that time, Enron, you know, had its sails open and was flying fast and with the wind behind it. It was the up-and-coming thing, the new economy, etc. And what was interesting to me the day I saw that press release was that Wisner had left a certain record as ambassador in Manila and ambassador in Delhi, which favored Enron. In both cases, largely through Frank Wisner Jr.'s influence, Enron got contracts to operate and build, in the case in India, massive power plants. In the Philippines, Enron got the contract to take over the Subic Bay power plant. And in India, this magical, fantastic power plant was to be built in Dabhol, which was going to run on liquefied natural gas. It was an incredible plan. A government that was in office for only 13 days conducted no other business than pass an allowance to let this plant be built. You know, and Wisner was all over. In fact, a staff member quite candidly said, you know, Frank brought the CIA in on this. I mean, he brought all his influence to bear to get Enron these contracts. And then, of course, he joins Enron's board. But that's not the only board. I mean, he's on the board of Ethan Allen, for instance, whose boss is another very interesting man who is a Kashmiri American and is very involved in the so-called dual-track diplomacy on Kashmir. So Wisner, politics, diplomacy, money, power, all these things swirl around him.
And AIG too, right?
Well, AIG was not Wisner, that was Holbrook. I don't think Wisner was on the board of AIG. But Holbrook certainly was on the board of the two great failures. Richard Holbrook, another, you know, huge, gigantic man in Democratic Party, diplomatic circles, on the board not only of AIG, but Lehman Brothers. And he made his money on both those, and Credit Suisse as well. So these characters, they swirl around between these boards making a lot of money and then influence peddling for various companies. Right now, Frank Wisner is with Patton Boggs, where his, which I didn't write about, his portfolio includes lobbying for Egypt. So Obama picked a man who is Egypt's lobbyist in Washington to go and lobby Mubarak. You know, on the basis of a certain vision of American foreign policy. It's a very bizarre kind of choice.
What do you think Obama's instructions to Wisner were? What message was he supposed to deliver?
Well, by the outcome, the message was at least this, that, you know, Mubarak, you have to cool it and you have to take yourself out of the picture. In fact, just a few hours ago, Christian Amanpour interviewed Mubarak on ABC, and she talked to him. Mubarak said, look, I'm tired of this job. I've always wanted to leave. He looked quite mournful. His son Gamal was sitting there. And Mubarak said, you know, Obama doesn't understand the culture of Egypt. If I leave now, there'll be chaos. He blamed the violence in Tahrir Square on the Muslim Brotherhood. So I think the instruction that came was you have to take yourself out of the picture. And that did not please Mubarak. But, I mean, in some ways, he gets his subsidy from Washington, D.C., and cannot be completely deaf to what they're telling him. I feel, personally, of course, no evidence, but the quid pro quo would have been that, look, you have to make the speech, say I'm leaving, but we give you some leeway to clear out the protesters. There had to have been some give there, because otherwise, there is no way the Egyptians would have acted the way they did.
Yeah, those guys who went through on horseback and camelback, I mean, was this a classic instance of a regime in trouble hiring what we used to in classical Marxism call lumpen elements to do their work for them?
Oh, of course it is. I mean, the rumor in Tahrir Square yesterday was that people had been released from jail, and the deal was petty criminals released from jail, you go out, here's a camel, beat some heads in, and then you are free. So, I mean, it was a sport for some people. Other people reported that there were big black SUVs near the October 6th bridge handing out money to some of these people. I mean, this is exactly as you put it. This is the lumpen who have been brought in to smash some heads. And it may very well be that some sections of the security forces as well, you know, just changed their clothes and came in and did what they have been taught to do, trained to do, beat some heads. So a combination of all this, it's not true at all that this was some spontaneous rising of a pro-Mubarak section. I can guarantee you there is the pro-Mubarak section in Egypt now is very small. What there is there's some who are saying go now and some who are saying that September is okay, others saying why not April. But nobody is saying Mubarak, you are our father, except his vice president, Umar Suleiman. He's very tone-deaf, gave a speech, said, Mubarak is our father. I mean, all that one can think is when Mubarak finally leaves Egypt, Umar Suleiman will go with him.
It was striking, the consensus that the American elite seemed to reach in just a matter of days, that it was time for Mubarak to go. He'd done 30 years of service to the empire, and now he's given his walking papers almost overnight.
Well, you know, American elites are very consistent in this, Doug. They are not inconsistent. You know, Noriega had done his service, then his time was up. Saddam Hussein done his service, his time was up. The point is, once you see the writing on the wall, it's better to eject your chap and maintain the structure in place. Unlike those who get excited, we may get excited, Mubarak is gone. I mean, are we saying Mubarak must leave, or this kind of pharaonic state has to be transformed, the Mubarakism must go? I mean, what the American elites are simply saying is, let Mubarak go, somebody else will replace them. In some ways, that was always the fantasy also of George Bush Sr. Let us bleed Saddam Hussein, let him go, and let a new fellow come. Because a new fellow means the whole world will be duped by that. I think that's what they were trying to do. But events are running a little faster than people have assumed. You know, in Tunisia, Ben Ali disappeared, and his structure has remained largely. It's not going to change overnight. I think they were hoping for something like that. Let our friend go. We'll give him a sinecure. He'll teach a class at Yale University. And in the interim, some other, you know, person will come. The structure will remain.
The contrast between Tunisia and Egypt is interesting because the repression in Tunisia was very broad and effective, and there really wasn't much of political opposition, or the media were much more repressed than in Egypt. Egypt, although repressive, there are opposition forces, some degree of dissent in the media. So what do you think now, as Mubarak leaves the scene, given this more complex structure in Egypt, what will the result be?
There are five opposition parties that have come together. Among them, the leading force is the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, to my mind, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is not identical to, say, clericalism in Iran. It's very different. The structure of, say, religiosity in Egypt is not the same as that in Iran. The mosques are not, you know, so well organized as in Iran, where the clerical establishment was both independent of the Shah and quite powerful on the ground. Egypt is different. The Muslim Brotherhood largely is trying to fabricate itself like the Justice Party in Turkey. So it's not a progressive force, but it's certainly not identical. You know, this fear-mongering over, is this the 1979 moment for Egypt, is, I don't think, correct. It's a little exaggerated. Nonetheless, Brotherhood is certainly going to be in the driver's seat. Lots of people are excited, saying this is the moment when the people are rising. People are certainly rising. Some people in Tahrir Square are talking about direct democracy. I sympathize with them totally, but it's also a little unrealistic. In the interim period, other forces are going to come. In them, among them, the Brotherhood is going to be right there. And I think that is what terrifies many liberals. It terrifies civil libertarians. Of course, it terrifies Tel Aviv. So I think in the interim, whatever happens, whatever combination comes in, the Brotherhood is going to be a big part of it.
In Iran in 1979, the so-called bazaar class, the sort of merchant national bourgeoisie, was very much opposed to the Shah because he was bringing in international competition. He was sort of globalizing in his day, and they didn't like it, and they wanted to return to a more protected national economic space. So they were an important support for the clerical forces. Anything like that analogous in Egypt?
Very much so. If you would like to just give names to them, Gamal Mubarak, for instance, represents the neoliberal force, you know, making not only Egypt reliant entirely on things like the subsidy from America, but also on tourism, you know, big hotels, selling parts of the national industry. They are essentially a neoliberal set, Gamal Mubarak and his cronies and friends. They are despised by sections in the military who are old-fashioned nationalists who want to see the Egyptian economy on a different footing. And that's a major clash among the elite. One side, neoliberal, reliant on tourism, reliant on America, in a sense, Egypt utterly dependent on forces outside its will, and the other side, ironically, the military. And the military is in this because one way in which the military was corporatized, brought into the pharaonic state, is the sections of economic life were turned over to them, just as they were in Pakistan. The military in Pakistan is essentially a big business. Similarly in Egypt, and that is the reason why the military is not fully supporting Mubarak at this point. There is definitely a fracture in the ruling elite at this point. Now, how it turns out is different. And as Paul Ammer, the political scientist, has put it, not only is there military, but there are there's such a vast apparatus of repression below the military. It's some sections of that apparatus that have been brought directly into presidential power. So there is the military who are saying we want to be neutral in this conflict, and there's some sections of the security forces that have put themselves behind Mubarak. So, yes, there is definitely a class split in the top.
And the military also got its hands in a lot of the privatized businesses and such, right? It's a major economic interest in the country.
Absolutely. But it's not in the sections that are utterly dependent on globalized capital. You see, so it's not got its hands on things like tourism. Tourism is still in the hands of that crony section that is around people like Mubarak's son and other youngsters trafficking Egypt as far as the old-timers are concerned.
I was speaking with Vijay Prashant, who teaches at Trinity College in Connecticut. I think a lot of the liberal bourgeoisie would like to see El-Baradei succeed Mubarak. What's your reading on that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, he's not an uninteresting man. People generally think of him solely from his time at the International Atomic Energy Agency, but El-Baradei had a life before then. I mean, he starts his career in the Nasserite foreign ministry and, was there served under one of the most impressive Nasserite figures, Ismail Fahmy, who, when Sadat went to Jerusalem, resigned his post, saying that this is Egypt being put in a position of utter dependence to the West. And El-Baradei was his deputy. El-Baradei then served with Boutros Ghali, and both of them left for the UN around the same time. So he's a very complicated man. You know, it's not correct to say El-Baradei, you know, was like he's in Vienna, he's Western. He has very, very interesting lineage. But, of course, he has no base. And it's true, his main place of residence is Vienna. I mean, Rahm Emanuel could almost not run for mayor of Chicago having moved to New York for 2 years. El-Baradei hasn't lived in Egypt for decades. So there is a problem with him lacking a base. But much of the liberal bourgeoisie in Egypt, sections of the secular parties, etc., have put their faith in him. Because he's, I mean, they think a credible figurehead. You know, over so many years of repression, very few other people have been allowed to rise. Ayman Nour is one. There are some few others that have been allowed to rise. But El-Baradei came in as a breath of fresh air in the last election. And I think one piece of it that's neglected is a lot of the frustrations in Egypt now are a consequence of this last rigged election where El-Baradei and others were just cast out. That was extremely frustrating. The 2005 election was frustrating, and so was this last election. So, I mean, he's a credible guy. The question is that he comes to this with a very limited politics. I mean, his political direct statements that he's made thus far are only there should be an open political environment. And that, you know, that is what we hear from everybody. Everybody says there should be an open political environment. So I'm not clear what his political vision would be, but his background is more complicated than just the IAEA.
These sorts of leaderless, spontaneous rebellions are extremely exciting. I mean, it's been wonderful to watch this going on, at least until the guys on horseback came in. But where do you go with this sort of thing? I mean, once the uprising has driven out the previous leader, there is a succession problem, isn't there?
Of course. I mean, the one thing that there is it's always an illusion to think that these things are happening without leaders. I mean, these are all organized opportunities. They mobilize vastly more people than are organized. But there are hubs of organized forces involved here. And what happens in most of these kind of rebellions, and the, you know, if you go back and look at the French Revolution, all these other revolutionary moments, there were always a hub of organized people, and they were able to take advantage of mass mobilizations that took place for all kinds of reasons. But it's that those small sections that then start to canalize energy. And I think that's where one has to look. You know, it's always exciting to think the people will rise, the people will take power. But the people can never rule without mediation. And there has to be some form of mediation. Now, what one hopes is those forces that are better organized, that are going to canalize some of this energy, one hopes that they'll be as open-minded and generous toward the mass mobilization that afforded them the opportunity for power, and not turn around and shut off all doors to the people who brought them to office. You know, that is always the insult of revolutions, that revolution is made by the mass of people, and the small groups that are able to take advantage then close the doors of the people. And that, I think, at some point, human history will have to have us evolve to learn, A, don't have the kind of misunderstanding that the people will rise, the people will take power. That's silly. People will rise, certain people will take power, but we must find a way for the people who take power to remain accountable to those who brought them there. That should be, I think, a very good lesson once again.
I know that Iran in 1979 isn't a very accurate precedent for what's going on now, but in some sense, there was this aspect in that it was a very broad uprising, secular leftist, hardcore Khomeiniites, a very wide variety of people in the Iranian Revolution. And then the clerics were able to put an end to all the rivals and take unrivaled power. Do you see any kind of set of structures in Egypt that would lead to some kind of similar outcome?
Firstly, what's very encouraging is that the main opposition parties are all communicating with each other, and they have put forward a common proposal. That, to me, is a very encouraging moment. Nobody is trying to go ahead of the curve and say, deal with us. Today, the vice president and the prime minister have asked the Muslim Brotherhood to come in for talks. And my hope is that the Muslim Brotherhood would say, we are not coming alone. You see, because I think if the maximum unity is demonstrated by the opposition, it may give them the example of working together and trusting each other. I mean, if Mubarak and his cronies are able to split the opposition up, when in fact Mubarak goes, the opposition will not trust each other. And I think these are the little test cases. If the opposition sticks together, if they learn to trust each other, if they are able to hold each other accountable, you may not get the seizure of power that happened in 1979. So let's see what happens. You know, I'm hoping right now that organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood, even though they may be the largest opposition, are still very weak in comparison to the Mubarak apparatus. So that weakness, I hope, will make them understand that they have to stand with the other four parties and then reach out to, you know, the students and others and try to bring them in through some kind of mechanism, you know, to keep trust between the various groups. That is essential in this kind of period when things are slightly cooling down, moving to the next phase.
And we've been talking all about Egypt, but this has obviously been a very broad regional rebellion, starting in Tunisia, but it's really spread across the whole chunk of the world. How did that happen? I mean, what do you think is some sort of extremely broad regional transformation underway?
Well, this has been something coming for a long time. I mean, you know, there are certain dynamics that are involved. My feeling is that the first thing one has to consider, even though Marxists are loath to admit it, but one of the big things is there's a demographic problem. I mean, 75-80% of the population is under 30. You know, they are reasonably well educated. There is some oil money that went into things, some social goods such as college, etc., were produced. These are frustrated people because despite some social goods going to them, the jobs are not up to the mark. Lots of frustrations, grievances. One-party rule has a tendency to breed grievances. If you're angry about other things, there's no vehicle to articulate your anger. Proper political spaces are not allowed. There's torture when people do protest. These grievances have snowballed. And finally, the largest grievance is civilizational. And that has to do with the sense in the Arab world of being in a humiliating position compared to the United States and Israel. You know, when one of the bloggers was asked, what was the spark of your rebellion? Was it Tunisia? And he said, no, it was the Intifada in Palestine in 2000. That struck me as very interesting. And he's right. The Tunisian moment was maybe the conjunctural spark. But there was a structural spark, which is that sense of humiliation. I mean, every time Arab countries try to assert themselves, they are smashed down. And I think that feeling is very, very general. Which is why, by the way, so many young people and others in Tahrir Square and other places are holding up tear gas canisters, which they made in the USA. You know, they are angry about this sense of being subordinate. And this has been building for a very long time. I mean, this is not a new thing. There were protests in Egypt for the last 10 years. Those protests were small, and they were sharp. They were heavily repressed, but they were waiting for this big conjunctural burst that took place in Tunisia. I mean, Tunisia brought all this together and gave people much more confidence to act as they have acted now.
And there must be a lot of nervousness in Israel about all this. And I was really struck to learn that Elliot Abrams and Robert Kagan have offered support for the protesters trying to remove Mubarak. So Israel must feel very alone at the moment.
Well, Israel is not only alone, but their entire strategic formula has gone for a six. I mean, Israel's strategic calculation was the following. In 1981, the peace agreement was signed. I think 79. The peace agreement was signed between Israel and Egypt. And there has been no major war since 1979. The last major war where Israel was actually threatened was the Yom Kippur War, 1973. Since then, there's been no major threat. All wars that Israel has been involved in since 1979, it has been the complete overlord, Lebanon 1982 and onward. I mean, nobody was posed a threat to Israel since the peace agreement. Israel's entire security policy is based on the fact that the Egyptian army, the largest land army in Arab states, is offline. And Israel was able to reduce its military budget from the early 1980s onward, that is, to garrison and police on the side of the Egyptian border. And it has become, therefore, essentially an occupying force against much weaker places. You know, that is southern Lebanon, the West Bank, and Gaza. In fact, today, again, Israel bombed near Rafah. The tunnels were bombed again today. So, in that sense, this has thrown Israel's entire security framework, and they are terrified. I mean, they held long cabinet meetings discussing this very thing. Imagine, let's say that in Egypt, the Brotherhood comes into government. The Brotherhood has pledged to abrogate the peace agreement. Imagine that hastily King Abdullah II of Jordan changed his government. But imagine if there as well, where the Brotherhood is strong, it has an influence in government. That will be very scary for Egypt, for Israel.
And what about American imperial policy? How much does this threaten the broad American strategy in the region?
Well, it depends where you think American policy is made. If American policy is made in Tel Aviv, of course, again, because of what I've just said, everything is gone. If American policy is to be a sort of more rational policy, then this may not be a bad thing. And I'll put it in this way. If you have a more democratic, reasonable government emerge in Egypt, and you have, therefore, the central axis of the Arab world turning towards a more dynamic, less resentful domain. You know, if this has spillover effects and you get perhaps regimes coming maybe in Jordan, in Syria, you know, if there's some spark, this could have a good effect for you and me in terms of our foreign policy. But right now, Washington, D.C.'s foreign policy is going through Tel Aviv. So for them, they are terrified. For our, because we also should think in terms of our foreign policy. For our foreign policy, this would be a boundless thing. You know, $2 billion need not be spent subsidizing Egypt and Israel in their meaningless engagement. And, you know, that can build trains so I can take a train to work. So my foreign policy will be happy if this kind of thing happens. But Washington right now, its foreign policy in the Middle East is derived almost entirely via Tel Aviv, and therefore it's also in disarray. And by the way, the real sense of that disarray has come in the kind of statements being made from Washington, D.C. On the one side, they want to try to celebrate this kind of hankering for democracy. It's just what Condoleezza Rice had called for when she went to Cairo. In fact, she spoke more openly against the Mubarak government than any other American. And the Mubarak government was very angry with the Bush administration for the speech she gave when she was in Egypt in, I think, 2005. So on the one side, the Americans want to say, we know what this is. This is part of our contribution to history, you know, freedom, liberty, etc. On the other side, we need stability. And they are speaking through both sides of their mouth, and that's very dangerous for the United States, for its credibility, which, you know, anyway is low.
The U.S. and Israel always said they wanted democracy in the region, but they didn't really, did they?
No, they want democracy, if Joe Biden said that Mubarak is a Democrat, so they have a certain idea of what democracy means. You know, they don't want this kind of democracy. They don't want the democracy where, say, you know, Hezbollah comes to power, or that Hamas comes to power, or Muslim Brotherhood. They want a certain kind of what in the old days used to be called in Indonesia guided democracy, where it's democracy, but it's the right people running things. Platonic democracy. This is real demos. This is where the people are going to rule. And, I mean, well, I agree. Sometimes the people can make mistakes, but if you believe in it, you have to go for it.
That was Vijay Prashad, who teaches history and international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. To repeat the correction I made in the introduction to the interview, when I brought up Frank Wisner's employment at AIG, Vijay contradicted me. But in fact, I was right. Wisner, whom Obama sent to Egypt as a personal emissary the other day, did work for a while at AIG, where he was a vice chair for external affairs, which is a polite way of saying he did PR and relations with foreign governments. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Some of Overthrown by Jarbo. Bye.
The elements they are overthrown.
The elements just stirring.
The elements they are overthrown.
The sea now it's running back.
The elements they are overthrown.
The fire now is going out.
The elements they are overthrown.
The earth now is trembling.
Shake.